Welcome to How to Become a Leader in Africa, the podcast where we uncover the fascinating logic behind leadership in African societies through conversations with Africans from all walks of life across the continent. I'm your host, Remy Adekoya. Let's dive into this week's discussion. Our guest today is Dr. Ibrahim Nye, Deputy Minister for International Cooperation and Economic Integration in Liberia's Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Before taking up his current position, Dr. Nye was a scholar, activist, and policy expert who has written on the challenges of rebuilding post-conflict societies and providing economic opportunities for Liberia's youthful population. Welcome to the show, Deputy Minister.
Thank you very much, Remy.
And so, the name of our podcast, of course, is How to Become a Leader in Africa. And since you have risen to a leadership position in your nation, Liberia, I just thought perhaps we could start with you giving us a brief background of yourself and how you came to be in the position you are right now.
And I grew up during Liberia's Civil War because those of us born in the mid to late 1980s were born and grew up in a very tumultuous era in the history of our country. Those were moments of political instability, which saw our country go into 14 years of civil war. So I grew up in that moment of the country's political development, political crisis, civil war, and then I saw the process of the process of the ceasefire. I saw the last civil war. I grew up being displaced multiple times and being even a refugee to Sierra Leone and then coming back again as a refugee from Sierra Leone to Liberia.
Wow.
And then by the time I was finishing high school, 2003, we were having the last and most difficult period in our civil war, the most severe point of the civil war. When rebels marched on the city to remove the sitting government and the president fled. And that year was in my final year of high school. And by 2004, we had already had a peace agreement. So my entire primary to secondary education was during the civil war of the country. And I didn't go anywhere. I was just here. And then I joined the student movement as an activist, campaigning for children's rights and campaigning for good governance, youth participation. And then at some point, I joined a government entity called Governance Commission as an intern in 2008. That was also the founder of my university education for the undergraduate degree in political science. I joined the Governance Commission as an intern in 2008. And since then, my career had followed a path of a policy analyst. I tried not to call myself a policy analyst, but I'm public policy and a student of political science. So my career picked up from the Governance Commission, where I had the distinct opportunity of working with a scholar and former politician, a former president of this country, a former interim president, Professor Amos Cicero. I became his research assistant and at some point his personal assistant for many years. And he inspired, motivated, and encouraged me to pursue a scholarly path. And then I grew up in the Governance Commission, stayed at the Governance Commission, went to the University of Maastricht, studied public policy. And after that, came back to the commission, worked as a research and policy analyst for 4 years. And then I went on to SOAS to study international politics and development. Actually, my PhD was in politics and international studies, with a focus on comparative politics. And I wrote a dissertation on decentralization and power relations in Liberia. Following my studies, as I came back to Liberia and started a think tank called the Dukor Institute for Social and Economic Research. And our focus was bridging policy and academia to help Liberia's transformation, particularly as Liberia struggles with data for development, struggles with evidence, and so many things that are needed for some that will help guide the development and transformation of the country. And also the Governance Commission, at the Dukor Institute for Social and Economic Research, which I co-founded with several other Liberian intellectuals and scholars of my generation. And then at this Duke Institute, where I got the call to come to public service as a deputy minister. And I can't say there was any particular thing that I to be appointed, because I don't think there's any formula. Other people have defined formulas for political participation and ascendancy in Liberia's political landscape, but most of the time, it hasn't been the case that they have succeeded in what they are doing. Some have succeeded in what they are doing, but I cannot say there's a particular formula to this. But I can say that the clear path that I've seen myself is to follow, to try as much as possible to follow the rules. And I believe the path to every career or whatever you want to do is not to target a particular position, but target self-empowerment and to prepare yourself for the larger economy or the larger the market. So I remember my former boss in one of our regular discussions, may his soul rest in peace. He said, "We, for me, and for many young people that he knows, he tells us to prepare ourselves for careers at three levels: national level, where you are able to get a job in your country, maybe in the public service or private sector, and two, you should also make yourself competitive internationally. That is, you should prepare yourself, get the education that is marketable in international space. And third, you should always have a fallback position if you cannot have a public service job or a private sector job in your country and internationally. You should always have something you can fall back on, and that is academia." But I didn't think academia was something to fall back on. For me, my passion has always been to become a university professor, and I still have that passion. I have that dream, though I think I have been ruled from that dream by coming to government, and I don't at this moment have the time to be on a tenure track. I had a dream, and I'm still passionate about this. I want to be a university professor, and but I don't now have that opportunity to be based in a university on a tenure track career path. But I still have a full-day university part-time. I do lecture. And the opportunity I found to keep myself in the academia while being a deputy minister is to enroll at the Foreign Service Institute. We have an institute in the university for diplomatic training, so I'm there as one of the lecturers as well.
Wow, that's fantastic. Thank you so much for that introduction. And just before we move on, thank you so much for sharing that story with us of how you came up and how when you were growing up, when you were completing high school, you know, there were still a conflict going on in Liberia. And I'm just wondering if you wouldn't mind now, if we could just sort of on a personal note, I'm really interested sort of what were the kind of thoughts going through your mind and the minds of your peers when you were at that time in high school. We're talking early 2000s, and there was still a conflict in Liberia. Sort of, you know, what kept you going? You know, how did you see the future? And just, you know, how was that experience? You know, for I mean, I have never myself been in the midst of such a conflict, so I'm just trying to imagine how that felt and sort of what kept you going then, and how you people saw the future at that time.
Well, Remy, our Civil War experiences are difficult to tell because I cannot tell you definitely in a definitive term how we navigated the struggles of the Civil War, the difficulties we experienced growing up in homes that were battered, in homes that were battered by poverty, in environments that where we experience violence every day, and almost every morning you wake up, there's a dead body lying somewhere, and no one takes account of that. And it became a normal thing in our communities where we saw people killed, and no one takes accountability, no one goes to court. Maybe the only thing sometimes that came out of some of these things were the person who did the killing, if there was another commander around, kill them, or maybe put them in some prison or torture them. And every morning we saw people being tortured, tied, and it became actually normal occurrences of our childhood. And what became fashion to us, I remember giving this strong man presentation to peers, like the models that we had in our communities at the time were the rebels, the commandos. So we nicknamed ourselves after them. Like a football player would call himself Ronaldo, a young football player would call himself Ronaldo, or a young football player would call himself a Messi. So while we were growing up, we were giving ourselves names of commandos. So they were our role models, because we were hearing the exploits of the, in the war. And unfortunately, we didn't know what was happening in our society at the time. I remember my younger brother, my two younger brothers were we nicknamed them after rebel leaders and commandos. And we called one person the other rebel leader's name, we called another person the other rebel leader's name, and they were proud of that. And myself, I'm not ashamed to say this. I named myself to another commander. And carry at that time when we met as young people in on the playground playing football was to threaten our friends that were child soldiers, and that's how they got afraid of us. And sometimes even working in communities with guys on our side, we need to show that we are also fighters, but we weren't. How we got out of this, honestly, how I did not become a child soldier, and most of my friends that I grew up with, I saw them becoming child soldiers. They became child soldiers. Some of them died. Some turned to drug addicts. Some are now at this stage of their life, not doing anything to contribute to society, but they were left, or society left them all by themselves, and they made contributions. So I cannot tell you that it was because of this I did not become a child soldier, and it was because of this I reached this point. I think I would say my parents, I don't know what they did to guide us. They fought for us to keep us in line. It was very difficult. I know there were times we would leave the house to go to the military barracks that were occupied by rebel factions just to cook for them. And I mean, help them cook just so we have food to eat and bring some food home. And then sometimes they have spotters for them. And then so everything that children did at that time, children that were considered child soldiers, we did that. I remember I did most of the only thing I didn't do was to carry a weapon and go to the battle to affiliate with the fighting force to get to eat or to get a looted good to sell, and then you get some pocket change as a kid. But we navigated that experience, and fortunately for me, unfortunately for most of my brothers, they tried their best, they struggled, they ensured that every time schools reopened, they ensured that we were registered to go to school, and they actually encouraged us to pursue education in the midst of all the difficulties of the Civil War. My mom was, I don't know if you know what we call kokbo in Liberia. In Ghana, they call that chop chop, those women who sell in makeshift restaurants. More send us to school to support us. And for many years, she did that before she passed in 2017.
Oh, may her soul rest in peace. There's an important element you mentioned there, which I think is very strongly linked to leadership, and that's the issue of role models. So you mentioned how, in some societies, people grow up and, the role models of the young boys are Messi, Ronaldo, those are the names they give themselves. And in that specific context in which you and your peers were living at the time, the role models were the commanders. So I think this brings us to a very interesting question around the kinds of people who emerge as role models in societies and why, and why. So some societies, perhaps, I don't know, someone may grow up in the US and their role model might be, I don't know, Bill Gates. And as you say, someone may grow up in another society and the role model might be Ronaldo. What do you think determines the choice of role models in a society? Because those are the kind of people young people grow up and want to be like. Do you think it is simply the dominant actors in the society, in that context of the society at the time, that determines the role models? And whoever the dominant actors are will be the role models?
It's a combination of the dominant actors in the society and inner passion or dream. In some cases, like growing up in the Liberian Civil War, the dominant actors, of course, were rebel fighters, commanders, and rebel leaders and politicians. And so many young people got conscripted into your rebel forces, or some of them developed interest in it, because also it was strategy. It was a survival strategy. Being part of a fighting force, you could easily get something to loot and feed your family. And so it also, being part of a fighting force, was security for yourself and your family, particularly if you were in an area where the tribal rift was intense, where people from certain ethnic groups were being persecuted. So it was a combination. I mean, it is a combination of dominant societal actors, and also, on the other hand, partly it's passion. So at that time, like I said, by the time we discovered new actors in the society, we saw new things that became interesting to us, and then we found different role models. For instance, when we finished high school, we started to hear other politicians and intellectuals on the radio talking, inspiring people, mobilizing us into actions, community and civic actions. Then we found that there were new role models, others who were intent on solving social problems and community political problems. And so we thought that was the direction to go. So we found new models at that time, new role models to follow. And again, when I moved to the Governor's Commission, and then I started to work with Professor Amos Sawyer and his passion for scholarship, that actually motivated and inspired me a lot. And then he became my role model in that line. So the dominant society actors do influence young people in many ways, to the extent, particularly when there are not alternative activities in the society.
Yes.
But when you have multiple activities that other actors are participating in, and young people are engaged with some of those activities, they quickly identify something that they will niche to, and then they find individuals in those areas to become their role models.
Yeah.
So that is very important. The actors in society, the popular culture as well, the intellectual culture, or the zeitgeist at the moment. Those who are the dominant intellectual forces driving the narratives of the society, the extent to which they are able to impact or influence young people, they can become role models to some young people in that instance. Like if you go to here in Liberia now, we see new things. It's not only a war. Over the last 20 years, we've seen Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. She's now a role model to young women. We've seen Lima Bobby, the activist. She's role model to many Liberian women. We've seen the Minister of Foreign Affairs. She also has her own history, her own story of struggle and working in the United Nations. So she's now role model to many Liberian women. So during the war, there was a lady fighting for called Black Diamond. At that time, it was she was role model to other young women who wanted to fight. But now there is Robeslo Nyanti, there is Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, there is Lima Gboyi. Many young Liberian women want to talk to Robeslo Nyanti. They want to be like her. So for those who are interested in football, they have the James Allen Sadiba,
George Weah, of course.
Who later became president. That's also very inspiring. And in fact, he told other people that you don't limit yourself to one career. His progress in politics tells people that you don't limit yourself to one career. Once you are done with this, you can transition to another career. And so he became a president. He went into politics, became senator, and became president.
Of course, fascinating. Thank you so much, Emma, for bringing up. So before, I mean, there's so many things going on here, but hopefully we'll be able to cover everything, definitely. But you're mentioning so many interesting things already. So you mentioned Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, and she, of course, is a hugely historic figure on the African continent because she was the first elected female head of state. So Nigeria, where I come from, you know, we've never had a female president. No one is even thinking that that's possible in the foreseeable future. That happened in Liberia. What do you think are some of the qualities that she possessed that enabled her to be able to rise to that position? And, you know, she was re-elected also. What made that possible?
Well, so many things were possible. So many things account for Ellen's ascendancy. Number one, let's give it to her that she's also a very strong, progressive, and persistent individual who desired great things for her country. And she joined in the 1960s, where she started to deliver speeches at school graduation and questioning positions of the government on major policy issues. And then she rose through the rank, became an assistant minister, and then later became Minister of Finance. And in the 1980s, she became one of the critics of the military government, challenged the military government, went to prison, and joined others to form a political party. So she already established her record as a political activist and politician in long in the 1980s, before the 1990s, when she became a presidential candidate. And so that record of political engagement and that record of public service, serving as finance minister, head of a bank, the government's bank, and her own educational background, connection to the ruling class before the 1970s, all were factors, and they all gave her the knowledge, the skill set to navigate the political scene that was male dominant. And so she had a lot of connections within the political class, including among the two dominant groups. First, the American Liberian class that she was socially affiliated with, and the indigenous class that she's originally from. And so she got to navigate her way through the class system, number one, two, the political system by being a politician from the 1970s, the 1980s, participating actively in the 1985 presidential election, and also joining with others to act to advocate and criticize very severely the military government and call for multi-party democracy when the military tried to establish a dictatorship. So when the country to election in 1997, the first attempt to transition from the Civil War to multi-party democracy, she contested that election against the most dominant warlord, Charles Taylor, and she came second. She took second place in that election. She lost the election, and again mobilized the factions around the opposition against Taylor mobilized. She was able to convince senior politicians from the 1970s and 80s form alliances and establish a very strong coalition around her unity party, and then she contested the 2005 presidential election and won. So she is adept at political mobilization, I think so, at the highest level. She knows how to bring stakeholders together around policy issues. And she actually knows how to navigate various political formations of differing opinions. She knows how to make her way through them and bring actors together around a common issue. Even when she was president, she was able to maintain stability based on this convening skill and the convening authority that she had while she was president. She was able to talk to warring factions. I can easily say that she has a knack on navigating various actors, even when they have differentiated positions on issues. She's able to bring them together around a single cause, and that's how she managed to stabilize her presidency and to continue to be elected two times, first as president, and then she went for the second term and won very successfully.
Interesting. So you emphasize here, it seems, relationship building skills. That seems to be something which she was really good at, as you see,
Exactly.
able
She
to
had very
build
excellent
relationships.
relationship building skills.
Wow, that's so interesting. And just last note on her, I'm just wondering again, because the gender issue does come up very often in when we talk about politics in various African countries. What was there ever a sort of, I don't know, a widespread sort of doubt of, oh, can a woman really lead this country? So, I've had conversations with people from Nigeria and other places, and people do ask those kinds of questions. They say, oh, I don't think a woman can really lead this country and other. Did people ask those kinds of questions in Liberia, or did no one doubt that from the beginning that she could lead the country?
Well, it's still an issue. People do raise that kind of question. People do raise them during elections. Even last week, we had a senator election here in one of the most populous counties, and the contenders were male candidate and a female candidate, the two leading contenders. And that question was raised, that issue of gender. Oh, we don't need a woman. But Madame Salif, her history of political activism and being among men who dominated the scene and working alongside them already defeated that position against her.
Yes.
So the question has always been, can a woman lead this country? Can a woman occupy this position? By the time Madame Salif was reaching the 2005 election, that question around her had been answered. So what the only outstanding question was just the traditional, the traditional question of, a woman to lead. It was no longer a question of ability and capacity to navigate political landscape. It was just the question of, do we really want a woman to lead? And that question, no one can answer it. Only traditional people can answer that kind of question. But can a woman lead? Yes, you have to look at a woman's track record. And Madame Salif's track record was clearly set. She was a minister. She was a governor. She has served as civil servant. She was politically active, went to prison. And those were all things that men did before. So Madame had done all of that. So
yeah.
when all the questions were answered around her, the last question now was, do we really want a woman? There's no clear answer to that, definitely. So for her, yes, that question. So a slogan emerged in the 2005 election when people were questioning whether we really needed a woman to lead the country, given that the country was emerging from a difficult period. That slogan was, Ellen is our man.
Ellen is
it
what?
Became very popular. Ellen is our man.
Ellen is our man. Wow.
Yeah. And it was printed on billboards. Okay. So people say, okay, we agree. We need a man to lead the country, but Ellen is that man. And
I
so
see.
Team used that, and even her supporters, the women movement, actually mobilized. We gave it to the women movement. They mobilized and send messages all across the country that this is the time for a strong woman, I mean, a very strong, competent woman to lead this country. And if the men say, and if people are saying traditionally only man we want, then Ellen is that man.
Then
and so
Ellen
you
is
will
that
see
man.
That
I
on
love
campaign
that.
posters.
Yeah.
Yeah, you will see that on campaign posters. Ellen is our man. And she mobilized a very good campaign at that time, even most of those who supported her were strong strong men from other political parties, including some warring faction leaders. So she had a very successful campaign that mobilized of the major force in society, even if not all, people from every segment of the society mobilized around her campaign.
Wow, great. Fantastic. Thank you so much for all that. That's fascinating stuff. And if we talk about you now. You joined the government last year. Could you share with us some of your initial impressions when you started working in the Liberian government, now interacting with the people who govern Liberia, who run Liberia? The actors you met and started interacting with, were they by and large what you expected? Did they defy some prior expectations you had? You know, we talk a lot about the people who run our societies in Africa, but it's interesting to get an insider's perspective. You know, what were your initial impressions?
Well, honestly, every time I talk to people in the government, I realize that so many people want to do a lot to change things, but they are all hamstrung by lack of resources. And we all complain, but then sometimes you ask, why are we all complaining? But then the problem still persists. And people are talking, I mean, if you meet a colleague in government, at the Ministry of Health, the Ministry of Transport, everybody is complaining. And then, but then why if we're all complaining about these things, they are not working. And so sometimes I sit back and look at things from a policy question. What do we need to do to resolve some of these things? Some, yes, we need resources, but are we actually deploying the resources more strategically? Sometimes, as in some cases, yes. And my initial impression was the energy I saw, the momentum from actors that want to really change things really quickly. But then, as we move along, you start to experience a snag. You want to get this done. There's limited financing. And then at some stage, you don't have the stakeholder support that you need. And again, I'm like, when I assessed the Ministry of Foreign Affairs where I work, initially I thought there was serious, significant capacity challenge in the ministry. Of course, most of the government public sector agencies across Africa, having worked for as a consultant for the African Union, done governance assessment in several countries, the stories of capacity challenges are unending. But
Yes.
when I come to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Liberia, I saw all these civil servants, and I thought that there are a lot of capacity challenges, significant ones. But then when I talked to them one by one after the other, reviewed their credentials, they all very credentialed, have most of them have good education. But the main issue is they are demotivated, poor incentives, low salaries, and limited social, almost no social security or program for most of the civil servants and even myself, public servants in the country. So you see that they actually could do their best, but they are not doing it because they are not incentivized enough. And some of them actually do believe that whatever they are doing, they will never get promoted because of what they are doing, but will only get promoted when someone, a political appointee, favors them. That is a reality. And so we are trying to change that story around. We're trying to change that narrative. Could we establish a system that is more meritocratic, that is driven blindly by the performance of civil servant on the appraisal system that has already long been established by government? So these are the things that I've seen in the government. I'm impressed by the credentials of the civil servants. When I was at the Governance Commission, where we drive governance reform and policy, where they still do, when I was there, all we continued to hear was, all the civil servants are not qualified. They do not have the requisite credentials. Some of them, most of them, were only employed by people who knew them, and most of them didn't get employed through a competitive system. Yes, true, in most cases. In other cases, I see CVs, qualified people, good training from good universities. But the underlying challenge is they don't have the resources to work. When I took over, I had to work with the minister to mo even mobilize computers for the civil servants here. Somebody with a master's degree in economics is sitting as a desk officer. He doesn't have the tools to work with. He doesn't have the computer. He doesn't have the internet. He doesn't have the printer. And the salaries are bad. And how is this person going to and change the system already? This is what most African public servants confront. And when we complain that there's no capacity, it's actually not because the individuals are not trained. It's because the institution do not have the capacity. And the capacity of the institution is a combination of the skill set and the resources available to those who are manning the institution. And that is what we need to mobilize. So I have this impression that there are civil servants who want to work, but they are disincentivized, they are demotivated, and it's that element that we have to work with to have our systems working, and also to focus on building a meritocratic system.
Okay, very
We
interesting.
don't have all of the answers in our administration,
Of
but
course.
we've understood some of the problems and we are trying to solve them.
And these problems, which you talk about at that kind of, general structural level, do you think it stems from simply there being an overall shortage of resources for everything, pretty much? Or does it stem from those who actually control the purse strings, perhaps not prioritizing the welfare of civil servants or feeling that there are, more important things that those resources need to go on? Where do you think sort of, the core of the issue lies?
I think it's the last point about prioritization, and I want to say in most cases we do misprioritize. We want to address the problem. I see people passionate about solving problems at the political level. The political leaders want to solve problems. They want to build their political capital. But to solve the problem, you cannot solve the problem with quick fix solution. You have to build an institution to sustain the problem, to sustain the solution. But because most politicians and maybe myself now included, given that I'm in a political position, we are always now thinking about how do we satisfy the electorate to get us elected in the next election? Are we prepared to actually take actions that actually hurt people but solve the core problems of the society? Sometimes not, and in some cases, yes. For instance, in the education system currently in Liberia, I'm passionate about education. We have all these people teaching who are not certified, who are not certified teachers. They are not trained, but they are all hanging on the government. They want to get on the government, on the civil service payroll, as government teachers, because in Liberia, interestingly, government pays well and pays throughout the year than most private schools. Private schools only
Interesting.
pay on a contractual basis. When the system of monitoring in a government school is not strong enough, is not effective enough as it is in a private school. So he will be punctual, or she will be punctual, more committed to the private school where she's taking 100 USD than in a government school where she's taking 100 USD, because she can easily be dismissed in a private school and not easily dismissed from government payroll. So issue of prioritization, issue of monitoring, it affects so many other sectors. And so the resources are there, but strategic deploying and building a system to sustain the solutions are the problem that we have in most of the bureaucracies in Africa. And I've seen this in countries that have done assessment for the African Union peer review mechanism, whether in West Africa, in Southern Africa. We hear these stories about government bureaucracies not being more efficient and more effective and being very under-resourced. Well, also is the chicken and egg situation. The ineffectiveness is to the lack of resources. And prioritizing is that the political leadership has to be focused on particular issues and address them from the bottom up. What is the problem with the healthcare system? The problem is not just about buying the hospital bed and donating it at a public ceremony, or buying the CT scan machine, organizing a public ceremony for a publicity stunt that the government or this politician has delivered a CT scan to this hospital. The problem is about building a system in the hospital so that the hospital is able to acquire its own CT problems without it being centrally controlled from the Ministry of Health or from the President's delivery unit. So these are the problems that we need to look at to address them institution by institution, to make the institutions strong, credible, and efficient enough to solve their own problems. So it's about over-centralization as well. Over-centralization of resources, over-centralization of power, and that power is the decision-making power. We have, for instance, community-level clinics that have to turn to the Ministry of Health at a central level before they can even get syringes for injection. That has to, those issues have to be addressed.
Very interesting. And you talk about, of course, that tension between which, you know, we find pretty much all over the world, but in certain places it might be more pronounced than in other places. That tension between politicians on the one hand wanting to be seen to provide, you know, sort of short-term deliverables that are visible, that people see and appreciate and say, oh, wow, this president is doing well. Look, they built a road there. Oh, look, that minister is doing well. There's a big new shiny hospital there. And as you say, these are things that can win them popularity, but may not necessarily solve long-term problems. However, on the other hand, the politician, let me do the strange thing here of taking the role of the politician, will say, but you know, the problem is that if I don't provide these short-term measures that are visible, that people can feel, they will not appreciate what I'm doing, or they will think I'm not really doing much, and they won't vote for me in the next election, and I will lose power, and I won't be able to do anything anyway. So that is something which I have to do. In order to be able to maintain popularity, I have to provide these deliverables that are visible, highly visible, at all these, you know, tape cutting ceremonies, etc., because otherwise people will think I'm not doing anything. So what would you then say to a politician who gives that argument? How would you persuade them that actually the long-term measures are worth it?
Yeah, so because we believe the long-term measures are worth it, every government I know since the return to civilian rule has developed a plan, a development plan, that is phased. For instance, we have our national vision, which aims to build a middle-income economy in Liberia by 2030, united around sustainable development and around a common national future. And so every 5 years, there's a development plan. So if every government decides to stick to this, to the objectives and the programs outlined in a development plan, we will build a society on a path of incremental development with one project building on the other for sustainability. Then short term, I mean, it guides against the temptation for short term political deliverables.
Yes.
Sometimes I call them pork barrel projects.
Yes, pork barrel projects.
Men, yeah, just selected at some point just to satisfy a constituency to accumulate political capital. And all of the development plans from Madame Salif, from PRS, Poverty Reduction Strategy, Agenda for Transformation, and to George Weah, to Popo Agenda, are clearly articulated development plans that, if followed, we'll see the kind of sustainable institution building we are talking about to solve the long-term problems. And attempts have been made actually in some areas to address these issues. But there are always disruptions when the next election is in sight. And then, when the next election is in sight. So what is needed in most of these cases is to lead processes of constitutional reform to support kind of multi-level and what they call a scattered system of governance, where power is shared, power authority is shared. Like you have federation, local government areas. I know from my study of decentralization, there's a lot of fight between the local government area and the state government, and between the state government and the federal government. Like you had a long struggle between Tinubu as Lagos state governor and Obasanjo as federal president. That tension exists in every society where there is multi-level system of governance. But it is the best form of governance that allow for local ownership and allow for the building of institutions at the local level to address and solve local problems, far more efficient and effective than centrally controlled planning systems. And then advocating for us to take Liberia, where we know politicians will always drive. I mean, we'll always have the tendency for short-term deliverables, particularly when they have ambition of being re-elected or when they want to establish legacy. But establishing legacy is about building institutions. That temptation will always appear. But when you have constitutional direction, or when you have legislative direction on national planning, on and organization of policy issues that is already legislated or constitutionalized and given power to lead these processes are given to separate institutions, I believe you can address this problem of short-term deliverables. And we've seen that short-term deliverables are not sustainable. Yes, they are quick fix solution, above the surface solution to the problems, but the problems do recur over and over, because the bottom line of building sustainable institutions to continue to provide the services have not been addressed. And I was telling a politician in the past, I was addressing a forum. I said, this, as a caveat, this is in my previous life as a researcher. I said, when politicians are building their houses, and when they hire the best architect, they ask people, give me the best architect to design my house. When they have the architectural design, they also ask for a good engineer or a good contractor to put the structure up, and they do monitor more efficiently. But when they are hiring for public service, they forget about the requirements of having the credential, of having the best, the best person in the field to occupy the position. They always think about who is available and who supports them. But in their private businesses, they advertise for their private businesses. They do competitive recruitment. So do this for the civil service as well. Because you have the protection of, I mean, you have the assurance of this public service delivering, and then you have the protection for your own future, because a more efficient public service gives you the social protection that you need in the future for even your own security. But it's always different. When they are hiring for their private businesses, they ask for the best recommendation for accountants, sales agents. But when they are hiring for government, they don't take that criteria into consideration seriously.
Yeah, that's a problem
And we have to hire,
in a
we
lot
have to
of places,
deploy the best
unfortunately.
places.
Yeah. And staying here still, Emma, for a bit on sort of the everyday practicalities of government and governance, and you've spoken a little bit about that. Were there any things that really surprised you? Challenges which you hadn't previously imagined, which, say, as an observer of politics or even a researcher of politics, had just never crossed your mind? And then you actually got into government and were like, oh, wow, I didn't even know there's this kind of challenge on the ground. Was there anything like that in particular which you recall?
Yes, I knew that there were always challenges, and but I didn't know the extent to which they were ingrained in a system, like getting things through the bureaucracy. I mean, people always told us that if you go to a government agency to get maybe a passport or a driver's license, they would delay you. But then when we came to the ministry, fortunately, I had a task of leading the passport reform. My minister at that time, it was I she had been confirmed by the Senate, and I was the only other minister political appointee confirmed. So she gave me the responsibility of leading the passport reform. I knew the process, there were challenges in the passport sector, but I didn't know how humongous this challenge was. And it was humongous in the sense that things were not getting through, but it was also easy to solve because you just needed a particular staff to make a paper today. And attention in this for acting on it, attention in this to another person who needed to act on it. But I could find out that people were just derelict on the responsibility. People were just, because it was just complete absence of monitoring and accountability system. So I thought initially it was because computers weren't working, and so it would take somebody 2 months to get a passport. But then when you the system, you streamline the system, it should actually just be 7 days. I was surprised at this, actually. I was definitely surprised that this could be addressed, this could be solved. And fortunately, we went through this passport reform. We now have a director in place who very dynamic, young and very efficient. And people are surprised. The public is surprised in Liberia, they are saying, but we are now getting passport in 7 days. And our men, interestingly, would be even civil servants who make the process to look so difficult. Only because they want you to pay extra fees. They make you, they tell you, you want passport? This is going to take too long, ago, but I can help you process this in. Yeah. But actually, it shouldn't be this way. So we have a new, very dynamic passport team now. We have a dynamic passport team that is making sure to deliver. And then because also now they are responsible, we've given them a performance management contract and a performance, which will actually tell the extent to which they are delivering or not. And it's also job security for them. They see it as a form of job security that if they deliver, they will continue to stay in this position or be changed. And if they do not, they're going to be changed definitely. So they are telling us now the returns are very high. And we are getting very good feedback from the public. People are applying for passports and not believing that they can get a passport in 10 working days or in 7 working days. And those who are paying for express, they can get a passport in the same day. So my surprise in the beginning was that how difficult it was to navigate the bureaucracy. When I started this process, I saw that it was just about individuals actually just taking their responsibilities seriously and also ensuring that they were. And now we have a system working, fortunately.
Interesting. Great. Great stuff, really. So your role is international also, because you're the deputy minister in the foreign ministry. So this means you also interact with a lot of international actors in leadership positions. Now, there seems to be a general consensus among foreign policy experts, and not only, that we seem to be returning to an era of great power politics, at least for the foreseeable future. Now, from your observations, what do you think that kind of atmosphere, that kind of a world, even if it's a multipolar world of great powers. What do you think could be the challenges and perhaps opportunities for African states in that kind of dynamic? Does thriving, or at least surviving, in that kind of dynamic for an African state require particular types of leaders? How do we navigate this, you know, this great power politics seas we seem to be sailing into?
Well, Rami, I tell you for sure, international relations is a new area for me. It's an eye-opener for me. For my studies, I was always only focused on comparative politics, looking at local politics. And now I'm in this role where I have to lead Liberia's international cooperation. That's in the multilateral organizations and also at the bilateral level, developing relations between Liberia and other countries, forging partnership and cooperation. I've seen what we need in Africa, and let me say in my country, in Africa as a whole, what we need are strong leaders, conscious of their environment, leaders who are determined to drive policy and to drive policy changes. That's what we need. We are already in the era of multipolarity or global power politics. The challenge now for African governments, for continental cooperation or regional integration, is that we still, from what I see in engagements, we still do have external influences on African governments at differentiated levels and in the various regions. We still have countries, actually, I'm not going to name any country here. Mm-hmm. We still do have countries who engagements in the international external influences that they have to consult other countries, other foreign ministers before they make decisions. And this has actually affected cohesion and policy coherence at the African Union level and even at the regional level in ECOWAS. We have strong external influences from the major world powers, from either superpower countries or major power countries. And this is affecting our future as African countries tied together, given the congruity of our territorial areas. And we are able, if we increase intra-African trade, we are able to create more jobs. Currently, I think the latest data shows that the total trade, only 30% of Africa trade is intra-African trade.
Less, I think it's even less than that. Yeah, it's even less than that.
I don't know over the last 3 months, since 2024, I mean 2025. So we have a challenge now with the African Continental Free Trade Area, which is trying to encourage African countries to the world as a single trading bloc. Mm-hmm. But there are other countries who are trying to undermine this process of integration, but engaging countries on a bilateral level. For instance, the EU want to sign a trade agreement with Kenya. The EU want to sign a trade agreement with Mauritius. The EU want to sign a trade agreement with South Africa. The African Continental Free Trade Area is saying, no, let's engage this process as Africa. Mm-hmm. Sign this trade agreement between Africa and the European Union, not as individual state. So that is a challenge. And we are having the same within ECOWAS. We are trying to have ECOWAS as a single trade bloc. And this has been developing over time. There has been some progress. So these are the challenges we are having, holding together as a bloc, and also even on the political front. South Africa took a case to the United Nations International Court of Justice. Having all of Africa supporting this case has been a challenge. And we know a number of countries actually did follow and supported this. But even at the last AU meeting, it was a difficult issue to have a common African position. So a cohesive continent, driven by the passion for unity and tackling the issues of Africa as one, has been undermined by external influences in West Africa. For over 20 years, they've been talking about a common currency for West Africa called the ECO. Mm-hmm. They have developed the West Africa Monitoring Institute, the West Africa Monitoring Agency, all geared towards this initiative. But the light is still very far the light is still very far and not even closer to, we are not even marching closer to the light while we since we've been in this tunnel to have this echo currency to help boost monetary stability in West Africa and to facilitate trade and transaction among the various West African countries. There has been some progress recently with the Pan-African Payment and Settlement System. They are trying to facilitate payment in local currencies. For instance, I can stay in Liberia, buy a product or a good in Nigeria without going through foreign exchange transaction, changing to the USD or to the euro before purchasing in Nigeria. The Pan-African Payment and Settlement System has made some progress. Platform, you use the Liberian dollar, buy a good from someone in Nigeria, and that person receive payment in the naira without going through foreign exchange transaction in whether the USD, British pound, before this transaction is completed. So that progress has been made. So I think incrementally we're going to overcome these challenges.
There's a very important point you raise here. You talked about there still being external influences on African governments. I think you mentioned even you talked about the foreign minister of an African state presumably having to consult a decision with the foreign minister of a non-African state, I'm assuming, before deciding, you know, whether to do A or B. And without, of course, mentioning any particular country names, much less individuals, what do you think underpins such mechanisms? Is it financial dependence? I mean, why would the foreign minister of an African state, before taking a decision in his country's or her country's interest, feel they need to consult, you know, the foreign minister of an external power for permission? Does that stem from financial dependence? What does that stem from?
Well, first, there's still the legacy of colonialism. I mean, I know so many countries make decisions at the AU or on other regional bodies by consulting external foreign ministers. I think there's still the legacy of colonialism. And the legacy of colonialism continues to drive financial dependence, where somewhere in some countries are actually dependent on other countries for international aid and all linkage are to external economies far more than they are linked to even countries that are bordering their territories. So all of that affects some of these things. And until you can get out of that shackle, you will continue to make decisions in consultation with other countries. And so sometimes the decisions you even make are not in your national interest or the regional interest, but you have to make them because you are expecting money for electricity in your country. You are expecting trade to continue to flow. You rely on that trade far more than you rely on the cross-border trade from aspect of your trade relations.
Interesting. And so, with regards to that, do you think, you know, because now there's a lot of debate, of course, around, you know, aid and, you know, with some of the actions of Donald Trump cutting USAID and things like that. And of course, there's definitely going to be a significant amount probably of short-term pain. There's going to be some services affected in some African countries that may be more reliant on that aid than others. But do you think long-term that is, you know, I don't, a positive thing? Do you think that actually it's good that, you know, this aid is being cut off because those countries will need to somehow find some other way of financing those services and have to look inward? You know, what's your take on that?
Well, I think it is regrettable that international development aid is being abruptly cut off by some countries, and some have already announced that they are going to incrementally cut down their contribution to international development. But also, we should see this as a challenge to take on greater responsibilities of our own future. For our own future is. It challenges us, it should inspire and motivate us to cooperate more among ourselves as African countries and prioritize our resources to address our fundamental development challenges and become more self-sufficient and self-reliant. So this is a wake-up call, and I know some countries have already begun to do so. They have already begun to do so. They are reprioritizing their budget, they are doing new allocation, they are dishing programs that do not actually require government financing, reallocating resources, and looking for other means to increase revenue generation. My country has just announced a domestic resource mobilization strategy, and there are plans now to do reallocation in many other sectors. So for me, it's a wake-up call. Yes, it's regrettable that it happened so abruptly, but it's also a wake-up call. It is time that we take the cross, we take our own cross and march to our own destiny confidently. We cannot perpetually rely on international aid. It's not sustainable. There is no data that shows that any country development aid. It has only kept countries reliant on short-term projects. The future is trade. The future is strategic investment. The future is generating and promulgating strategic policies that are forcefully implemented and intentionally implemented by national governments. And I see that direction. Many countries are now pursuing that direction. And again, it is not wrong for countries to consult with allies or their strategic partners on international policies. Strategic must not be taken in the extent that it undermines cooperation. Mm-hmm. Consultation is part of the game in international cooperation and diplomacy, but I would only think that Africans will always consult in ways that they ensure that the strategic interests of the African Union or the African bloc is foregrounded in all of the consultations they do, not consultations that lead them to or making decisions that undermine regional integration, but satisfy the political objectives of external actors.
You mentioned that to navigate these waters we are sailing into, or we're already in, of great power rivalry, Africa would need strong leaders. African states would need strong leaders. Now, what's your understanding of what a strong leader is? Because, you know, there's this whole debate around, you know, sort of strong man leadership, and a lot of people have criticized that and say, actually, you know, some people say what Africa needs is, you know, strong institutions, not strong leaders, etc. So when you talk about strong leaders, what do you understand? What kind of leaders are strong leaders?
Strong leaders, in my opinion, or in my view, or from what I've seen, are leaders who get things done, are leaders who follow the rules, and leaders who are determined to implement the rule of law and the objectives of their constitution. For me, leaders who abuse power, who use military or police forces to suppress protests and establish themselves as authoritarian are not strong leaders. For me, they are rather weak leaders, insecure and fragile in their position as leaders, or have very fragile ego. So strong leaders are leaders who ensure that their constitutions and legislative instruments are fully implemented. They are deliberate about their policy actions, and they consider the will of the people and ensure that the mandate given to them and the constitutional responsibilities are fully implemented. For me, that's my definition of a strong leader.
Okay, I think that's a very good definition, if I may say so. So finally, what advice would you give to young Africans seeking to transform their frustrations into real political influence? What qualities do you think are most critical for them to be able to succeed in leading us to that peaceful, prosperous, and strong Africa we all dream of?
Again, I will say that I don't have a prescription, and because I don't think I've achieved myself, so I'm not the right person to give that advice, given that I'm still climbing the ladder, or I'm still making my way through life and through public service. But I will say that what I've seen others have done is that you must have a career path for yourself. You must define a career path. It's not about targeting a position. It's about targeting self-empowerment and making yourself competitive and giving yourself a skill, and also following the golden rules that your parents gave. I know every parent, all of us, our parents tell us to remain humble, to be obedient to rules, and to continue to serve where we are called upon. But the underlying thing is we must seek self-empowerment. You must have the skill, you must have the knowledge, you must have the education to before you even venture to consider yourself for a position that you want to occupy. You must seek the skill set, and that will lead you even to greater heights, to heights that you do not originally imagined for yourself. So, and obviously the golden rule of being humble, being obedient, and following the rules of the society and the rules of the household that you originally grew up in are all very important. So again, there's no prescription that I can give at this stage, but this is what I've seen.
Thank you so much. I'm Dr. Ibrahim Ney, Deputy Minister for International Cooperation and Economic Integration in Liberia's Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you. Thank you, Remy. It has been a pleasure, and it's a distinct honor that you've given me the opportunity to share my thoughts and my views on these issues.
Thank you so much. Thank you for listening to How to Become a Leader in Africa. If you enjoyed today's conversation, don't forget to subscribe and like and review the podcast on your favorite platform. It helps more people discover these vital discussions. You can also visit our website to drop your comments and suggestions, which we always welcome. Join us next time as we continue exploring the logic of leadership in African societies. Till then, take care of yourselves.